Oh my God. Welcome back to the podcast. Wow. This is the second episode back after like 2 months of radio silence on the podcast front. A lot of people in my comments were like, bring People Pleaser back. When are you going to do the podcast again? When are you bringing the podcast back? It's back, baby. This is week two of being back. There's one, if you didn't know, there's already a new episode that came out last week, and this is a new episode this week. Still no guests. I just got stuff I want to talk about, not necessarily with a guest. I just got stuff that like I need to work out in my brain on the mic. Somebody on TikTok said that I look like a rapper, Jacques Cousteau trying to be a rapper, because I'm wearing my Steve Zissou red cap, and I've got like a little like blue jacket on, and I said, yeah, my rap name is Jacques Cousteau, J-O-C-K Cousteau, spell the same, Jacques Cousteau. So I look out for that album dropping soon, my rap album under the name Jacques Cousteau. And also, speaking of albums, my double vinyl is out. Beautiful Things, the deluxe edition. You can get it on my Bandcamp, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, or at the link in my bio at any of my social medias. Go check that out. It's a great time to get yourself. Pick yourself up one for, as a Christmas gift to yourself. You deserve it. We're live on TikTok. We're live on YouTube from a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. This is People Pleaser. How are you? If you're on YouTube or if you're listening on Spotify, you've already seen the title of this episode is Carl Jung, Mother God, and the Reliably Destructive Nature of the Human Ego. So that's what we're going to be talking about, okay? Primarily today, I want to take a look at why it is that human beings struggle to understand what God is. And I am saying what God is, not who God is, or like where God is, just what God is, and how to use the concept of God for good. Now, I want to make it clear that I am not saying in this episode that I've got this figured out, that I know exactly what God is and exactly how to use God for good. I'm more or less just looking at like why humans fuck this up so often. Why so regularly, with the best of intentions, when we try to define what God is, and when we try to come up with a modality or a system of using the concept of God in some way to help people, we mess it up so often. Like we just fumble this all the time, whether it's organized religion or whether it's just sort of your garden variety backwoods cult. We have a really hard time figuring out how to use this concept for good. It always seems like we're trying to use it for good. That always seems like the intent. It always seems like when people start a religion or a cult, the idea is to do something good with it. Or when people are tapping into a story about what they think God might be, they're doing it in an attempt to elevate their life and make their life and the lives of people around them better. But so often, almost exclusively, it winds up going south and being used poorly, and people wind up getting hurt. And so I wanted to take a look at that today and talk about it and see if we can, like, maybe, I don't know, come up with some theories on what might be going on there. Before we get into that, I will say, I've never been more confident that we live in a simulation than I am right now. I'm not a huge simulation theory guy. I don't think about it very often, but I did just buy a Meta Quest 2. I just was in Target the other day and I walked by and they were selling the Meta Quest 3 and the Meta Quest 2. And I thought, and the Meta Quest 2 is $250. And I was like, should I get a Meta Quest 2? It's like, should I be a VR guy? And I thought, should I get the 3? And I thought, no, I'm just starting off. I'm just starting off in the VR universe. I don't need to get the newest, fanciest one right off the bat. Let's just see how the 2 suits me. And I've spent the last 2 days in the VR vortex. And I tell you, you spend like a few hours in there zipping around. I was in Banff, Canada, on the banks of a lake, just looking around. A moose was off in the distance. I was underneath a glacier. I was out in space on a meditation app called Trip. You know, I was doing all, and you take that off and then you look around at the world immediately in front of you and you're like, oh, well, I mean, shit, if we're like second generation of doing VR helmets and it's that transportative, it's that it has that much power to like trick your brain into believing it, even though it's like the image is kind of blurry and it's not crystal clear and it's not as crisp as it could be, and you can still feel this heavy thing sagging off of the end of your face, but your brain is still like, I don't know, I kind of buy it. Like, your brain is like, we might as well be here. Maybe my eyesight's just a little bad. Maybe, like, I am in Banff, Canada, and my eyesight is just a little bit worse than it used to be. And my, like, the thing that makes me dizzy when I have the VR headset on is whenever my character walks. So sometimes you can walk your character with, like, a joystick. Like, you can move forward and around. And whenever I walk and I'm stationary, I'm instantly sick. My brain doesn't know how to process that. It's like, body is not moving, but body is moving. And that's because my brain believes it. My brain believes that I'm in that room. And so it's very disorienting when my body starts to move, but my legs are not moving. And my brain has not given the command for my legs to walk. It just told my thumb to move a joystick. And now we're walking. And I don't know. I take that headset off and I look around my room sometimes and I'm like, yeah, I mean, we might as well be in a simulation, right? Like, we might as well be in a simulation. Like, if we're already doing it, if we're already, someone said, is this a live or a premiere on YouTube? It's a live. You're here live. I will be talking to the comments more later on. And we will be getting back to simulation theory. That's going to come back. That's going to come back near the end of the discussion, but let's get into it. We have a lot to talk about. So anyway, that's just a little bit about, I got a VR headset. I might upgrade to the 3. I'm that into it. I'm a fan, and I might go back and get the MetaQuest 3 and just get the fanciest version. We'll see. Yeah, I guess Elon Musk was right, and it's a simulation. who knows? Okay. Carl Jung, God, and the reliably destructive nature of the ego. Let's talk about inflation. Not economic inflation, but egoic inflation. This is a concept in Jungian psychology. I believe this was sort of a term that Jung sort of coined. I don't think that he really came up with the idea of having an inflated ego or having your ego sort of like take off and that being not good for a person. But the idea is simple enough. It's just sort of the concept of the ego becoming inflated beyond the point where you sort of lose consciousness of the self and of objective reality. So it's inflating beyond the state of consciousness into a state of unconsciousness. You lose touch with what is actual and what is real. And this can happen in two ways. There can be positive inflation or negative inflation. And positive inflation is just, you know, an inflated sense of self-importance, an inflated sense of grandiosity of like, you know, so you get a promotion at work and all of a sudden you start treating all of the people that you used to work with, that you used to be at the same level at, you start treating them like inferiors and you start viewing yourself as being superior to them. And you are experiencing positive ego inflation. Your ego is becoming overinflated and you are losing touch with the reality, which is you are the same as those people you used to work with. You are the same person who used to work at their level. You were just given a promotion arbitrarily by the management or the leadership at work. You're not actually any better or any special, more special than them. And then it can happen with negative inflation as well, which oftentimes these are things that people experience in a swinging pendulum. Oftentimes when your ego inflates in a positive direction really big, it has a tendency to swing back and go the opposite direction. And you can get negative inflation where you believe that you are a uniquely terrible person. I think you see this a lot with like abusive partners and relationships where you can sort of have, you'll see like people who are, they have an inflated sense of what they can get away with in a relationship, and they'll maybe, you know, carry on an affair thinking like, I can do whatever I want. Different rules apply to me than apply to my partner. My partner's not allowed to cheat on me, but I am allowed to cheat on my partner because I'm special. I get unique rules in the relationship. And then when you're caught and the house of cards starts tumbling down and your partner's threatening to leave you and you know, everything's falling apart, your ego inflation swings to the other side and you come to your partner and you're talking to your friends and to your partner and to yourself about how no one in the world has ever been this terrible. No one's ever been this awful. You are a uniquely terrible person. You are a uniquely shameful person. You are a uniquely, you know, tragically vexed person. You become, either way, you're the main character of the universe, right? You're either one of the most amazing people the universe has ever seen, who is worthy of special rules and special consideration, or you're one of the worst people the universe has ever seen, and people still need to forgive you. People still need to let you off the hook because you're having this incredibly unique experience. You're not having a human experience. You're having a superhuman experience. You are superhumanly good or superhumanly bad. You are superhumanly gifted and blessed, or you are superhumanly yoked with tragedy by the universe. The universe has just saddled you with this curse of being such a terrible person. And either way, this is a way that the ego gets us to disconnect from each other and from a sense of oneness and communal belonging and universal connectivity. And I think as I've been reading about this, and so this is something that somebody in my comments brought up. I made a skit on TikTok about how I think most cults and religions get started. And it was after I watched the documentary, Love Has Won, The Cult of Mother God on Max. I hate calling it Max. It's HBO Max. I'm going to say HBO Max for as long as people still understand what I'm talking about when I say that. I really don't like saying Max. I don't like that HBO is not a thing anymore. It's HBO Max. It was such a bad decision, business decision, to change the name to Max. The recognizable brand name is HBO. We all recognize HBO as like the station that has created many of the greatest television series in the history of television. We want to watch HBO. We don't want to watch Max. Was that David Zaslav that did that? Was that idiot that did that changed HBO Max to Max? I think it was. Fuck that guy. but anyway, I was watching Love Has Won, The Cult of Mother God, and I was just like, this is so funny because all that's happening with Amy Carlson and these people is like, they just got stoned and they had like the realization that college stoners have in their dorm room where they're like, whoa, we are all one thing. We are all connected. I'm God. You're God. Everything's God. And then Amy Carlson heard that and her ego was like, I'm God. I'm going to start a cult where I'm God. And I made a skit about that, and somebody commented on there, and they mentioned this concept of inflation from Carl Jung. And they were like, yeah, it's where the ego confuses itself with God. It gets an inflated sense of itself, and it confuses itself with God. And that is one of the things that can happen with inflation, but it's not the only thing. Sometimes people, their ego does get inflated to the point where they actually think they are a messianic figure, like either a messenger of God or God itself, God himself, herself, itself. This can also happen with like the disciples or the people who follow these people. Like, I am one of God's chosen. I am one of the elite. I'm in one of the inner circles of the God of the universe, the God, the singular God. I am one of the people lucky enough to be in close proximity to this being. And all of this is sort of collective egoic inflation. But yeah, this is sort of where this was introduced to me. And as I read about it, I was struck with this idea. And I don't know if Jung talked about this or not. I couldn't find anything in there about it. But I was struck with this idea that, like, the goal of the human ego and the reason why human ego tends to be so corrosive and so destructive, the goal of the ego is to get you to buy into separateness. It's to separate you from everything else, from everything that surrounds you. Not just other people, but other things, other living beings, other animals, just the environment around you. The goal of the ego is to make you feel like you are separate and better than or worse than whatever, but just to make you different from, to take you out of, somebody said on TikTok, nature. Yeah, to separate you from nature. In AA, they have a term for this. They call it terminal uniqueness. And this is something that I've dealt with a lot in my life, definitely, and in my sobriety journey. Terminal uniqueness basically means, like, I have an egoic desire to be unique to the point where it will kill me. So somebody asked on TikTok, to what end? And I really actually think that it is, like, to the end of my destruction, to the point where, like, I will separate myself out from people so much that it will, and this is, and Jung talks about this too, that egoic inflation, especially positive inflation or negative inflation, dissociates people from healthy behavior and puts people in such an unconscious state that it can't help but result in some kind of dangerous calamity. In many cults, you know, like you've got like, you know, people committing mass suicide and things like that, or people subjecting themselves to abuse, cults going down because it turns out that they were breaking the law, and the law steps in and everybody gets arrested and goes to jail. But like, usually people are met with some kind of calamity. They go into such, dissociative behavior. This uniqueness pulls them away from pro-social behavior and puts them into such a state of antisocial behavior that they are met with some kind of calamity. Oftentimes, people die. But yeah, that's why the phrase is terminal uniqueness. It's uniqueness that is actually terminal, that will actually kill you. And the way that this is experienced by people in recovery is you want to believe that your disease, that your process of addiction is unique, that it's different from the way that other people experience it. So you go to an AA meeting or something as an addict looking for help. You're in the throes of your addiction. You can't put 2 days together of sobriety. You can't stay away from your drug of choice for longer than 48 hours. And you're desperate for a solution. And you go to this place where people are telling you, I'm like you, I have the same problem that you have, and here's what I did to get sober, and it worked for me. And all you can think is, you're not like me. I'm different from you. We're not the same. And the part of you that wants you dead, that wants you to be in pain, that ego part of you does not want you to relate to those people. Those people who are looking at you, you're telling them your story, you're saying, like, I'm desperate, I've tried so many different things, I'm so depressed, I'm constantly anxious, I can't fathom functioning without my drug of choice, I need it to function in everyday life. And these people are looking at you going, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm the exact same way. That's exactly how my disease functions too. We're the same. And they're telling you, like, yeah, you don't need to like explain it to me. I'm the same as you. And here's what I did to get better. And our ego screams at that. Just like, no, you're not like me. You're not like me. I am uniquely beset by my addictions. The way that I experience addiction is unique. I have such a, I mean, I had a sponsee once who told me that. He said, my problem with AA and with meetings is I don't think that those people understand the depths of my disease. I don't think that they can understand. And he started telling me, I'm not going to tell you the details of the stories that he told me, but he would go like, you know, I've had like this thing happen to me or this thing happened to me. And they're like these really dark, fucked up things. And I'm literally looking at him going, yeah, I heard somebody say that in a meeting yesterday. Like every story you could tell me as an addict, whatever it is that you experienced heavy abuse growing up as a child, that your parents were addicts and they gave you alcohol for the first time when you were 6 years old, and that you did cocaine for the first time when you were 12. Like whatever the story is, I've heard it. I've heard that story, you know, that you went through a phase of your life where you were constantly browning out and coming in and out of brownouts and blackouts while having sex with strangers and things like that. And like, it's like, yeah, I've heard these stories. I've heard all of them. But the disease, my ego wants me to be separate. It does not want to believe that other people have had a similar experience to me, or even like the same experience where people are like, beat for beat, that's my story. And the reality is that, like, none of us are actually that different from each other. Like, our stories are not as unique as we want them to be, and that's really hard for our egos to handle. That's a really, really tough thing, tough pill to swallow. It's that feeling you get whenever you're, like, telling someone about the sad stuff that's happened in your life, and it's this story that makes you feel like you're particularly strong and particularly brave, and that you've been a survivor, and so you're talking about something sad, and then somebody tries to relate to you and says the sad thing that happened in their life that they feel like is on similar footing to what you're saying, and you feel like affronted by it. It's like, how dare you try to compare our stories? They're not the same story. Even if what that person's telling you is like also horrific, you're just like, I didn't ask for you to compare yourself to me. What I'm trying to do in this moment is assert the profound uniqueness of my circumstance and of my situation. And so that's what I was thinking while I was reading about egoic inflation from the Jungian perspective, is that like the goal of the ego is to separate me from the experience of the people around me. And when I am in humility and trying to push against what my ego is telling me, I am more capable of listening and relating to my fellow human beings. So when people are telling me a story about something that's sad that happened in their life, I can actually see myself in the story and see how me and that person are the same. It's, you know, like snowflakes and fingerprints. When you look at a fingerprint on a piece of paper, you know what it is. A fingerprint looks like a fingerprint. You know what a fingerprint looks like. And at the same time, every single person has their own unique pattern to the fingerprint. Snowflakes are the same way. Faces are the same way. Even identical twins, it's like you have mostly the same face, but you might just have here or there a different blemish on your cheek or a different wrinkle here or there. Your faces aren't aging the exact same way. You have different haircuts and different facial tendencies and things like that. Everyone gets their own unique thing, but that doesn't mean that it's so unique that you are separate from. You're still part of the same thing. You're still unmistakably a human being having a human experience. That's, you can't escape from that. And that's going to work. That's going to feed into this idea of universal connectedness that we're going to talk about a little bit. I do want to spend some time here talking about Amy Carlson. So we've introduced the concept of egoic inflation, how it can be positive or negative. In the case of addicts, it's like this negative thing of like, no one's ever experienced addiction as intensely as I have. And we've talked a little bit about the concept of terminal uniqueness, the way that the ego wants to create separateness and give you a story that can separate you out from the experience that the human that people around you are having, that can make you feel like you are having a truly special, truly a heightened, special on a heightened plane, like an inhuman, a superhuman experience. And so that brings us to Amy Carlson. So if you haven't watched this documentary, I do recommend it. I will issue a content warning and advisory for the podcast. They have one on the show when you watch it. It says there's some disturbing material in here that some viewers might find hard to look at. But I will just reiterate that and tell you that I've talked to several friends who told me I wasn't ready for how hard that was going to be to look at. You watch this woman die in slow motion over the course of three episodes, and you watch her body wither and rot and literally change colors, and it's pretty hard to look at. But it's interesting, I think, as a case study, when we're talking about God and why humans tend to get God wrong so often, to look at what happened to Amy Carlson, because it's kind of beat for beat the story of like what happens with humans and the concept of God. So Amy Carlson was just sort of an average American girl. She had a tough upbringing. Does seem like there was some abuse in her past, and that she was abused by adult figures in her life that were trusted figures, and that led her into a cycle of picking abusive partners as an adult and seeking validation from abusive partners. And this is all, again, like, there's nothing terminally unique about this. This is actually all very human and very familiar. It's a story that you've heard before. It's a story that might even be very close to your story. But it's certainly not a story that separates Amy Carlson in any distinguished way, where she was having some kind of special experience with abuse or trauma. She was just having a very human experience with abuse or trauma. I'm not saying that to lessen or to diminish or diminish her trauma in any way. And I think that that is also what the ego feels too, is like when you say that someone's trauma is normal or familiar or something that is experienced by a lot of people, that you're somehow diminishing. It doesn't diminish our experience to acknowledge that our experience is that there are elements of our experience that are universal and that are familiar and that are human and that are commonplace. That does not diminish the impact of the experience that we're having. But Amy Carlson was having this experience, and in the process of having this very human experience with being caught in a cycle of abuse and cycle of trauma and a cycle of trying to find validation from abusive figures who are also probably themselves victims of abuse, who were caught in abusive cycles and things like that, she wound up having two children with two different men at an early age. And I don't think that she ever particularly wanted to have children or really like made a conscious decision to be a mother, but she didn't make a decision to give those children up for adoption or to have an abortion. She had the kids. And, you know, so she's now having this experience where she's trying to be a good mother and trying to be a good sister and trying to be a good daughter and still trying to find validation from these men and these partners who are sort of keeping her in this perpetual cycle of abuse and disappointment. And I think ultimately what Amy Carlson, where she was when she set herself on the path to becoming Mother God, is she was just profoundly disappointed with the experience that she was having. She was profoundly, yeah, just upset by it. It just was not what she wanted for herself and her life, and she felt trapped in it. And I think that this is also not a terminally unique situation. I think that this is a very common thing for people to sort of wake up at some point in their adult life and go, is this really the experience that I wanted to have? There's got to be more to life than this. And that's a thing that a lot of people have experienced. That's a lot of people have, yeah, somebody wrote unhappy. Yes. You know, so Amy Carlson did what a lot of people in that situation do. And this is again, common. It's unfortunate. And I feel, I have sympathy and empathy for her children, but she just left. She abandoned her children, she abandoned her family, and she just fucked off. And she just took off and just said, I'm going to make a radical change in my life. And she sort of, I think, made a radical decision for herself that she was going to, maybe for the first time in her life, prioritize herself. And I got to say, as I in no way am condoning Amy making the decision to no longer be a mother to her already existing children who were depending on her and who needed the love of a mother. I'm not condoning this behavior or saying that it's okay, but I am saying that like so many cult stories and like so many failed God stories and religion stories, I think that this one does start from a place where the attempt was to do something radically positive. I think that what Amy Carlson believed she was doing here was making for the first time in her life a choice for herself and for her own happiness. And she was doing what she wanted to do for the first time in her life. And she met this man online who was just this new age hippie guy. And she went out to where he was, met him, and within a matter of weeks, they fell in love and they got married. And this guy's in the documentary, and I feel so bad for this guy too, because again, I think that where the two of them sort of start at the beginning of this spiritual journey is like doing psychedelic drugs together, taking acid, taking mushrooms, maybe doing some ayahuasca, who knows, you know, smoking a lot of weed, maybe doing some MDMA and tripping out on some music and getting really, really into a psychedelic experience and having this, sort of awakening to an awareness of universal connectivity, that everything is the same thing. Time is a flat circle. You know, time is an illusion. So many things about the world that we live in are illusionary. There is more to existence than just the limitations of one person's mind, that all consciousness is connected. you know, transcendental meditation, people talk about this. Marianne Williamson talks a lot about this, you know, how like waves in the ocean might look at each other and see, I'm one wave and there's a wave over there on the other side of the shore and we are two separate waves. But if they're not aware that they are connected by the body of water underneath them, they're missing the greater truth, that they're not two separate waves. They are, you know, functionally two separate waves that are crashing down on the shore in unique different ways, but they are the same body of water. And that's sort of how human consciousness works too. It's all swimming in the same water, the same, you know, fifth dimensional frequency or energy. And so Amy Carlson has this experience that, again, so many people have had, so many college aged people who are doing psychedelics with their roommates for the first time, or people who are going to a rave for the first time, have had, where they're going, oh my God, I'm part of a bigger whole, a bigger picture here. And her and this guy that she marries, I can't remember the guy's name, but poor guy on the documentary, he's like, I just thought that we were talking about how everything is God and everyone is God. And so he and Amy start calling themselves Mother and Father God. But they're just talking about how, like, I'm God, you're God, that cloud over there is God, the earth is God, every human being is God, Mars is God, the sun is God, you know, it's all God. And again, like, as a starting off point, there's something to this that is counter to what the ego wants. And that's why I'm like, I like this. I lean toward this. My personal spiritual lens leans more toward this, this idea of universal connectivity, because inherent in it, it feels like inherent in it is a rejection of separateness. My ego wants to get me into separateness, wants to separate me out from the herd and from the greater picture and make me unique to my own detriment, make me terminally unique. And this sort of theory of universal connectivity that can be promoted through a healthy medicinal use of psychotropic drugs and a healthy approach to spirituality brings me into the whole, that I am not separate, that I am not unique, but I am part of something bigger. And that does not make me different or it makes me the same as everything. It makes me one with everything. So it's a little more Buddhistic in that approach. It's a little more like maybe Eastern in a spiritual philosophy, you know, and there's just so many, I think that so many new age, especially like new age white people getting into psychedelics, start here. They start here with this space of being like, oh, we're all swimming in the same water. One way that I like to think about this when I think about universal connectivity and oneness and the rejection of separateness is that like human beings are conscious appendages of the universe, experiencing the universe through a subjective conscious experience, but we are not separate from the universe. So the same way, if you think about like, what is the universe? If you actually ask yourself that question, what is literally physically the universe? I guess you would say it is all of the space that contains everything that is, right? So it's the unfathomably large expanse of space that contains all of the multitudes and trillions of galaxies, that contains our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, and all of the other incalculably large amounts of galaxies that are swirling and expanding out from the origin point of the Big Bang. That's the universe, right? So if that's sort of a rudimentary functional definition of the universe, with essentially just like everything, right? Just the big room that we're all in, the big expanse of space that we all exist somewhere in. Nothing inside of that space is separate from the universe, right? There's not a single galaxy or a single comet or asteroid or a single molecule that is separate from that big room that we're all in. It's all in it, and it all is it. It's all literally the same thing as the universe, which means that you and me are the same thing as the universe. We are not separate from it. We're no different than any planet or or star system or asteroid. We are not just in the universe. We are the universe. We just simply have to be, right? And there's sort of a self-evident logic in that, that when someone says that, it's like, that makes sense. That makes sense, right? You know, in AA, in the AA literature, it's said in certain places that God is either everything or God is nothing. And I like that. This idea that it's like, I don't think that God could be just one thing and not other things. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me, that God could be. And again, that is an idea that promotes separateness, that God is something that is separate from me, separate from you, separate from Earth, separate from the living beings here, separate from the galaxy, separate from the universe, that God is a separate entity. That doesn't seem to make sense to me. So this idea of God, this concept of God that people are trying to tap into with religion and with cults, seems to me, there seems to be an inherent logic that leans toward it just is the essence of being. Eckhart Tolle talks about God and says that God is being, the nature of being. So just the current circumstances that we find ourselves in, whether it's a simulation or not, we'll get back to simulation theory again near the end, as I said, whether it's a simulation or not, the current circumstances that we find ourselves in this conscious experience is that stuff is being. That, like, we are being, we are here, we be, we happen to be instead of not be. The universe happens to be instead of not be. And that state of being, that state of existing, that is God. And that is what Eckhart Tolle describes as God, is just this overarching state of being. So, okay. Conscious appendages. I'm going to talk about conscious appendages, then we'll get back to Amy Carlson. So, again, if we are conscious appendages of the universe having a subjective, so we are the universe having a subjective experience of itself, it's sort of like if each one of my fingers developed its own individual subjective brain and personality and came to life and started talking to each other, and like one of them's like, hey, I'm Tony, and one of them's like, I'm Jimmy, and one of them's like, my name's Elvira, and like, yeah, I'm like, my ring finger is a woman, because why not, and my pinky finger is non-binary, and their name is Buck, and and they're all talking to each other and having this experience of feeling like they are separate entities because they're capable of chatting with each other and experiencing each other as different and with different personalities and different ideas and different opinions and different perspectives on things. But then I step in and go, but you're all fingers on my hand, which is connected to my arm, which is connected to my body, and you're all connected to me. So you're all just me. And then they don't like that. They reject that. They all have their own ego. They all have their own little finger egos. And they go, no, I'm not. Maybe they even experience some inflation. And it's like, I'm not. I'm special because I have this ability to have a subjective experience. And so again, I did say at the beginning of this episode that I was not going to actually be able to give you the answer of what God is and how to best use the concept of God. And that's in the same way, I'm not ever going to be able to give you an answer as to like why our egos exist. But I do think that it has something to do with the subjective nature of our experience and the subjective nature of like being stuck in one body at a time, creates the necessity of an ego to have a sense of self. But that ego then spends our entire lifetime putting in this illusion of separateness, making each one of my appendages think that it's actually separate from me and a different thing. The same way that we all think that we are somehow separate from the universe, that we are not the same thing as the universe, even though it's like, you can't not be the universe. If the universe is everything that is, then that's you. That's what you are. So, okay. So that's my riff on where I think Amy Carlson started with this guy who she left her family and she got married to this guy. I think they started in this space. And I think this is where so many religions and so many cults start, this space of like tapping into something that feels like it has a self-evident inherent logic to it. Where she got tripped up is her ego heard that phrase, Mother God, It heard other people referring to her as God, as the mother of creation, and it lost sense of proportionality, and it lost a grip on objective reality. And she moved from a conscious state into an unconscious state, and she experienced some inflation. And so this commenter said to me, inflation is where the ego mistakes itself for God. And I think that that's like half correct, because I do think that people get, they get confused when they have these mystical spiritual experiences, whether they're influenced by psychedelic drugs or whether they're just having a really great time at a concert or whether they were at a particularly powerful church service, whatever it was, people do get confused. And I do think that is the ego that does the confusion, but I don't necessarily think that it's inaccurate to describe oneself as being the same thing as God, as being not separate from God. That if God is everything and you are part of everything, then you are at least part of God. You are not separate from it. I don't think that that's necessarily inaccurate. What the problem is Amy's ego steps in and says, only you are God. You are having a superhuman, unique experience, a unique experience on a more than human, an extra human level. Other people are not capable of experiencing their divinity in the same way that you are. Only you are capable of doing this. And so she runs with that, and she starts to promote herself in the greater world as the God, the mother of creation, the creator of all things in the universe. And she starts to amass followers. And the followers start to have a similar experience of egoic inflation with her, because every time she meets someone and shines her godly light on them and lets them experience being so close to God, and she compliments them. Everyone describes like a moment that they have with Mother God early on. They all call her mom, and they always have like an experience where they got to sit with her and she gives them a compliment. She says something nice to them. And it's something simple. Like, she just says, you know, you're brilliant. They do something nice for her and she looks at them and she goes, you're brilliant. You know that? Or they're doing something and she says, I couldn't get by without you. I can't believe you're cleaning my house. Like, where would I be without you? And that experience of feeling like you are uniquely important and special to God creates egoic inflation. What else could be more important than that? No job, no family member, no friend, no familial relationship could be more important than being in the inner circle of the God of creation. And so everyone together starts having this egoic inflation, and they're all pumping it up with more and more and more drugs and alcohol and all this stuff, and getting high on their own supply. And then when it inevitably goes south, which it always does, they start experiencing negative inflation too, of like, we become victims of the world. The world is persecuting us and hating us because we have this truth, because we are so tapped into the reality, because we are so special, we are being uniquely preyed upon. And the reality of their situation can actually be observed by objective outside viewers. So we get to come in and watch the documentary, and the documentary crew gets to come in and film everything and hang out with them and talk to them about their experience. And we get to watch it from the outside objective lens. And somebody in the comments just said, Robin. Yeah. I don't know if you guys knew this, but Robin Williams is a big part of the documentary. But like, we get to watch that, and everything that these people are experiencing as supernatural, their house burns down and it forces them to move to Colorado. And the way that they're experiencing it in this unconscious, separate worldview where their ego is super inflated to the point where they're incapable of seeing things through an objective lens, and they're incapable of any kind of humility, is, oh, our home had to be burned down so that we would move, when really all that happened is just like they were trying to sage their home and they just started a brush fire. Like, it's just like, it's just so common, so normal. There's nothing supernatural about it. It's just like, you started a brush fire. And then there's things with Amy. Like, so, Amy's so similar to so many cult leaders like Keith Raniere or Larry Ray, if you watched the Sarah Lawrence documentary. One of my favorite things about cult documentaries is when the cult followers describe the leader, and they, to hear them describe it, they describe just like the most amazing person. Like, when you hear people describe Keith Raniere, they're just like, there's something about being in Keith's presence and getting to talk to Keith and being lucky enough to talk to Keith and hang out with Keith, like, he's one of the smartest people you'll ever meet. And then when you, being removed from the inflated experience that they're all having, get to look at it, you're like, there's absolutely nothing special about Keith Raniere. There is nothing remarkable about Keith Raniere whatsoever. One of his party tricks that he used to do that would blow people's mind is he would, like, sit down and play Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven, and he would talk about how he taught them, or he taught himself how to play. He taught himself how to play piano, and people would just be like, I mean, this guy's the smartest person in the world. He taught himself how to play piano. And I watched that, and I was like, I taught myself how to play Moonlight Sonata on the piano when I was like 13. I did that. And I'm not saying that I'm a musical genius, because I'm not at all. I just, like, have a good ear, and I like playing instruments, and I used to spend a lot of time as a teenager teaching myself how to play songs on the piano. That, by the way, is not that unique of an experience. I know a lot of musicians and instrumentalists who taught themselves how to play instruments. Like, humans who want to learn how to play instruments can learn how to play instruments, whether they're doing that through lessons or through just, like, sitting down and figuring out a way to play the instrument. Like, instruments were designed by humans to be played by humans. It's not a sign of something supernatural to be able to play an instrument, even if you taught yourself. But people in Keith Raniere's cult needed to see Keith Raniere being able to play Moonlight Sonata on the piano as a sign of Keith Raniere being some kind of superhuman who was beyond the intelligence of normal human beings, because the reality of their own inflated experience depended on it. And it's the same way with Larry Ray, the Sarah Lawrence cult. Everyone talks about Larry Ray like he's this amazing man. And then you see Larry Ray, you're removed, you're having the objective view, and there's just nothing special about Larry Ray at all. There's nothing special about anything that he's saying, anything that he's preaching. There's nothing interesting about him. He's profoundly ordinary and just, like, and also, like, wildly abusive, which is also very common for cult leaders. It's the exact same thing for Amy Carlson. So to look at photos of Amy Carlson online and the promotional material around the cult of Mother God, it's lots of photos of this new age hippie looking attractive woman with prayer hands who's smiling all the time. And all the promotional material is like, did you know that God is alive and on the earth and she's a woman? She's the best. And to hear her followers talk about mom, they just talk about what an amazing woman she is and how she's just pure love and she just emanates this aura. And then you get to sit down and watch the documentary and have the objective, removed experience of observing these people who are having this inflated unconscious experience. And Amy Carlson is just straight up a violent alcoholic, just a belligerent drug addict and alcoholic who is decimating her health with her drug and alcohol use, and is regularly passing out and throwing up from alcohol poisoning and verbally abusing her followers when she's just shit-faced and can barely stand. And they're all just taking care of her, waiting on her hand and foot. And there's nothing special about Amy Carlson's experience with alcoholism or drug addiction. She's just having, like, a pretty standard run-of-the-mill experience with being a drug addict. She's being super narcissistic, super self-centered, super abusive to the people around her, wreaking carnage everywhere she goes. But her ego has put her in a position to amass enough followers to have that inflated experience with her, to separate themselves out from objective reality enough that they're all seeing it as some sign that she's special. I mean, there's, like, a moment in the documentary where one of her followers says, one of the reasons why I know that mom is God is because no human person could drink as much as she drinks and handle it the way that she handles it. Like, she drinks all day long and she really keeps her shit together. And I was like, I'm watching this thing and I'm like, two things here, pal. One, she is not handling her alcohol well at all. Like, I'm watching this documentary and I'm like, this woman is visibly drunk in every scene of the documentary. Like, she is visibly fucked up and shit-faced the entire time. Like, she is not keeping her shit together at all. Somebody asked Larry Ray, who is that? Larry Ray started a cult at the College of Sarah Lawrence. Check that out. There's a documentary on Hulu about it. That was wild, too. Larry Ray was just some guy that got a bunch of... He was, like, 40 years old, and he got a bunch of college-aged kids to live with him and be in his cult. And, again, Larry Ray, just nothing remarkable about him. He just asserted himself as being special in some way. But yeah, Amy Carlson just asserted herself as being Mother God, creator of all of the universe. And everything that she did in the eyes of her followers was supernatural. Even being able to drink an exorbitant amount and stay on her feet and stay conscious. And I was like, so two things. One, she's not holding her liquor very well. She's very visibly fucked up the entire documentary. And two, if being able to drink a lot and, like, still be somewhat coherent makes you a god, then I am a super god. Then I am way more god than Amy Carlson ever could dream of being, because I will say this. Amy Carlson and I could have been buddies, because she could drink the same way that I drank, and she could hang with me and drink all day long and all night long the way that I used to drink. But I will say this, I do believe that I was better at keeping my shit together than Amy Carlson was. I never threw up, and Amy Carlson was throwing up a lot. I always made it home to my bed most of the time, usually. And it wasn't until like 4 or 5 a.m. that I started losing my ability to speak or walk properly. And that's usually when I would, like, stumble home. Like, when I lived in New York, I would, like, stumble to a bodega and I would hold myself up by the fence and, like, you know, like, walk with my legs barely working. And then I would sort of say through a tight mouth to the guy that owned the bodega, I would say, "Can I get a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich?" And he would make me a bacon, egg, and cheese, and I would get a Gatorade and a bottle of water, and I would limp home and carry myself by the fences and hold myself up on the wall, and then I would drag myself up my four-story walk-up apartment, and I would make it to my bed, and I would eat my bacon, egg, and cheese in bed while smoking cigarettes out the window, and drink my water and Gatorade and go to sleep. So I think that's a case for me being God as well, if that's evidence that a person is God. But there are so many things that Amy's doing in the documentary that they're like, so it might look to the untrained eye like mom is sleeping right now, but she's actually in Thetic conference with the Galactics. So she's like passed out a lot, right? Like, she's just like asleep a lot. And that's normal for a drug addict and alcoholic of Amy's stature. But they're like, no, she's in Thetic conference. It looks like she's sleeping, but she's in Thetic conference. And it's like, no, guys, she's passed out. And that's really the funny thing about the entire documentary, is there is actually nothing that crazy or unique about the experience that any of those people are having. Essentially, they're just living in a crack house. Like, there's no functional difference from what they're doing to, like, people who just choose to be like, reality is really hard for me to accept. Life is really, really hard for me to handle. And I really like crack. And I don't care if my friends and family don't want to be around me when I smoke crack. I'm going to go live in a house where I can smoke crack all day long and just, like, be on crack with people who want to be on crack with me and want to just, like, escape reality with me. And that's all that those people were doing. They keep talking in the documentary about, like, responsible drug usage. They're like, look, alcohol can be bad for you, but if you use it responsibly, it can be really good medicine. And I'm like, cool, yeah, but none of you are using any of these drugs, even close to responsibly. Like, you are heavily abusing all of the drugs that you're taking, especially alcohol. Anyway, long story short, Amy Carlson wound up dying of liver failure and colloidal silver poisoning. She was determined that colloidal silver could heal her failing liver, even though she never stopped drinking, because Robin Williams willed it so. Robin Williams would show up and say that mom needs to drink more. So she was drinking like a gallon of liquor a day and drinking some crazy amount of liters of colloidal silver a day to try to offset her liver failure. And she died of colloidal silver poisoning and liver failure. Just like one would, just as any human person would, who was drinking and using as many drugs as she was and only treating themselves with massive amounts of colloidal silver. And fun story, she did turn blue. Her skin turned blue because of all the colloidal silver she was drinking. And it's pretty disturbing to watch. But that's the sad story of Amy Carlson and her profoundly ordinary cult that she started. Nothing special about them, nothing supernatural about the experience they were having, nothing superhuman about the experience they were having. But so what? Like, why? Why does this keep happening? Why is Amy's story so ordinary? Why is it so hard to escape? I think that Jung is onto something with the ego. I do think that there is something about being trapped in a subjective perspective that makes it really hard for us to stay. So like, it's like if Amy Carlson could have stayed with the first guy that she married, she still would have been a woman who abandoned her children and abandoned her family and left everybody. And that still would have been not great, but she could have maybe stayed in a space where she was at least tapping into something that didn't make her the main character of the universe, but just made her one with the universe. And maybe that could have been something that could have been more healthy for her. Maybe that would have led eventually to some form of healthy functioning sobriety for her. I don't know. But she pushed it further and got lost in the egoic inflation. And that's almost always what happens. I think it almost always starts off that humans are tapping into something. We meditate, or we take mushrooms, or we take acid, and we tap into something that makes us feel a sense of greater connectivity, that there's something bigger going on. There's something that we're not seeing. There's something that my existence is bigger than just the experience that I'm having in my mind. I'm connected to something bigger. But almost invariably, we get caught up in our ego. And a lot of times what organized religion will do, so cults usually it'll be one person like L. Ron Hubbard or somebody who says, I am either the messenger for God or God itself, himself, herself. And you all need to follow me and worship me as a messianic figurehead. And that's where cults go wrong. Organized religion does have messianic figureheads, but they're usually long dead. They're usually people from like thousands of years ago that are still worshipped as gods today. But organizationally, the problem is still the anthropomorphization of God. So I talked at the beginning about like this concept of like, what is God? Why are humans failing to understand what God is and how to use God for good? And I think one of the big ways that we fail to understand God is we make God in our own image. And that, again, is a symptom of ego, right? We project humanness onto God. God must be a human like us, or a humanoid personage. God could not be a bear or a lion or an octopus or some kind of fifth dimensional creature that we can't even conceive of. God has to be a human person, and usually a dude. So if I can give the cult of Mother God any props for anything, it would be thank you for at least making God a woman, even though they only like half did that. They also had Father God, and Father God was also like a big part of the problem in the cult. Go figure. Like, you introduce an abusive guy into the picture, and all of a sudden things get worse, and it's like, yeah, you know. Somebody just said, a yellow butterfly on YouTube just said, God was the OG weirdo. But again, I think that so the ego's drive to create separateness, and the ego's drive to boost self-importance, whether that's through a negative lens or a positive lens, creates a false image of what God is in two ways, I believe. One is that God is separate from you. So there's a thing that people say in AA a lot that bothers me when they say it, because people will go, all I know is that there is a God and I'm not him. That bothers me for a few reasons. One of them is it really irks me when people use he, him pronouns for God. And just, I'm like, there's always just this assumption that God is a man. That, like, of course it's like, it's just a guy somewhere. And I will always have a problem with that. Just the idea that God is just some dude. Like, that's really what, like, 90% of the world's religions believe, is God is some guy, straight up. And that, like, really, I know that it's like, no, it's Allah, or it's the Buddha, or it's Jesus Christ, or Elohim, Elijah, whatever. But it's like, but that's some guy. That's just some guy. You're, it's just a story about some dude. It's some guy. So when people say, all I know is that there's a God and I'm not him, it bothers me for two reasons. One is the anthropomorphic gendering of God as it's a guy, it's a person, it's a human, and it's a guy. Bothered with that. And also this idea that, like, you're not it, that God is separate from you. God is something else that you need to worship, that you need to humble yourself to, that you need to bow down to, and accept that you are God's lesser. You are subservient to God. You are inferior to God. And I think that when people say that, the attempt is to be in humility, to say, like, hey, I'm not God. And it's the same, but, like, you're still anthropomorphizing God, creating God in your image, and still sort of elevating yourself by being like, aren't I so humble by being able to acknowledge that I'm not God? And I still think that this is driven by ego. So the ego is doing the two things that it does. It's separating you. It's making you separate from the thing that you are experiencing as God. And it's also creating an inflated sense in two directions, an inflated sense of what God is, that you're not that, and then an inflated sense of how pitiful and pathetic you are, that you could never be that. And I think this is the core root of, like, why we can't use this concept to really help people, and why it almost always goes south and winds up hurting people, and people get killed, and people, families get torn apart, is because it is rooted in the ego, which is the goal of the ego is to create separateness. So two more things I want to talk about, and then I will go to the audience. And what I want to talk about here is my theories on possibilities of what could be going on here in the greater cosmic picture. Now, the first one is what I want. This is the one that I lean towards. This is the one that I want to be true. And because it's the one that I want to be true, it's the one that I'm more skeptical of. And I'll explain that a little bit more. But the first one is kind of what I've been talking about this whole time. This idea of universal connectedness, that everything is one thing, sort of egg theory. We are all the same thing. We're all experiencing all of existence and all of consciousness, just sort of through one subjective lens at a time, but we are not actually separate. Our separateness is an illusion and is what it's corrosive to us. J.K. Clark just said toxic individualism and abdication of responsibility. I think that's a really good thing of, like, what's happening with the anthropomorphization and externalization of God. Somebody also asked, Tony asked, does ego have any advantages? I don't know. That's a good question. We could think about that. But as far as my theories of, like, what might be going on here, yeah, my theory that I want to be true is this idea of, like, Mother God was half right when she said, I am God of all creation. I am God, because she is God, but she's not the God and the only God. She is God in the same way that everyone is God, in the same way that everyone within the sound of my voice is God, in the same way that this microphone is God, in the same way that everything in creation is God, that what you are tapping into when you are trying to have an experience with that thing people are talking about when they talk about God is you are tapping into just the universality of like the just that all things are one. What Einstein was tapping into when he discovered that time is relative, that time is relative to the observer, that it is only real in the mind of the observer. What he was tapping into is just this idea that like the construct that our subjective lens gives us is largely an illusion. And in reality, we are all tied together and connected. And I mean, I'm, like in a scientific sense, this does, the reason why this seems to have an underpinning, self-evident, intuitive logic to it is because it's like, in a very literal sense, yes. Like the materials that make me up, that are my organs, that are my stomach and kidneys and liver and lungs, the atoms, the molecules, the bacteria that create me is all part of an unbroken chain going back to the beginning of life itself. Like, these materials have continued to reproduce and grow and evolve and morph and mutate in an unbroken line. So no one alive today just blooped into existence. None of us just, like, went, like, one day, bloop, you were just there as a baby and you were fully formed. We all came in a very slow process through just molecules that grew into one person, and that person met another person that grew in, that had grown into a person, and they reproduced and they created a new person that with their genetic material, and that thing grew and morphed and mutated and met another thing that grew and morphed and mutated, and they reproduced, and it all went like that until you. So you literally are, in a scientific, biological, foundational, nuts and bolts sense, inextricably part of the overall whole of the human tapestry, as crazy as that sounds. And so my theory is that religious people and people who start cults are nudging up against that truth, that foundational truth that everything is one, that everything is connected. They are bumping up against that and glimpsing that idea, and their ego is creating a situation where they anthropomorphize God, they externalize God, they make God this superhuman entity that's usually a guy, it's usually just some dude, and then they start going, our story, our version of God is better than other people's version of God. They start to separate themselves out from the rest of humanity by going, I know that you guys talk about God, but the way that I talk about God is actually the right way to talk about God. The story that I have about God and me and my group have about God is actually the correct story. The name that we've given our anthropomorphized God is actually the correct name. And the book of rules that our anthropomorphized God has given to his messengers is actually the correct book of rules, and everyone else's correct book of rules or everyone else's book of rules is incorrect, or their interpretation of the same book of rules is incorrect and our interpretation is better. So it's this ego that is in all these situations that's going, my church is better than your church. My dogma is better than your dogma. My version of God is better than your God. My godliness is more godly than yours. My divinity is more valid than yours. So it starts just like Amy Carlson. It starts with that nugget of truth. She meets that guy and they do some drugs together and they realize, you know what? We're all connected and it's all love and it's all energy and we're all part of this energy. And it's like, oh, that's so beautiful. Her ego takes over and it turns into what humans always turn it into. So that's my first theory of what might be going on there. My second theory, and this is, I don't want it to be this, and that's why I worry that it might be this, is that we're actually just all wrong. That, so again, it's sort of an Occam's razor thing where it's like, I think you hear this argument from religious people a lot where they say, if God isn't real, then how come humans for thousands of years have been talking about God? How come so many different religions have been created to try to get at the, like, what this God thing is? It seems like humans somewhere in their bones, in their soul, innately know that there is a God, and they're trying to figure out what that entity might be. And that's the argument that they make. But then at the same time, you could make the same argument and go, if God is real and is a thing that everyone should be striving to have a relationship with, how come every single time humans try to create an organization around the idea of God, it gets so badly fucked up and it gets turned into such a problem? Maybe what's going on here is that the circumstances we find ourselves in existence are significantly less beautiful and interesting than we like to, than spirituality likes to make them seem. And this is sort of the thing, right? Like, what Amy Carlson was trying to escape is trauma and abuse and a cycle of abuse and a life that she was profoundly disappointed with and profoundly unhappy with. And everyone that followed Amy Carlson and joined her cult was doing the same thing. These are people who were war vets who were trying to escape their trauma, people who had been abused in their own lives and things like that, who were very disappointed with the experience of life. Most people who join a church or, you know, get baptized into something, most people who discover spirituality through something are trying to escape the disappointing, grim nature of their own existence, because when we actually look out at reality, we see all of these failing institutions. We see all of the failing, our failing spiritual and religious institutions, our failing governmental institutions, our failing economic framework, the way that our ambition and greed is killing our planet, and the way that late stage capitalism and industrialization has consumed, you know, like 70% of the world's forests in just like 100 years, and how unsustainable that is, and the way our self-destructive nature. We see war and people hating each other because your story about God is different from my story about God. Racism and all of the pain that we cause to each other, and maybe there isn't actually some higher truth of we're all connected and it's all love and everything, but we create that story as a way of escaping the grim reality, which is we are cosmically, profoundly, existentially alone, and we are deeply flawed and cruel creatures who are constantly hurting ourselves and each other, and confronting that is too painful. And so we create myths and stories and lore that makes it feel like we're all part of something better and bigger and more exciting and more interesting. And that's so that's why I doubt the first possibility, is because I really want it to be the first one, because the first one makes me feel, even though the idea of universal connectivity and everything being one and everything being that we're all God, that I'm God, that you're God, even though that feels more humble and feels like it's pushing against what my ego wants, I still think that my ego is involved in there in some ways, because it's still, there's two things going on here. One is I'm still sort of separating myself out and going, I'm acknowledging the actual truth that everyone's tapping into some kind of reality here when they're doing religions, but all the religions are wrong. All the cults are wrong. All the religions are wrong, but I'm actually closer to correct. So I'm still making myself special here. I'm still making myself like I'm tapping into the real thing. And also, it just makes me feel good. It makes me feel like life and existence isn't so grim and isn't so bleak and isn't so dark and hopeless. And that's where simulation theory comes in. So I told you we were going to get back to simulation theory, and then I promised we're going to go into the comments. The simulation theory comes in because what could make us want to escape the reality of our existence? And obviously the reality of our existence is that we live in a harsh, cruel, unforgiving world, that the only certainty in life is death and suffering, that like you, if you are going to exist, you are going to experience pain and loss, and you are going to experience cruelty, and you are going to inflict cruelty on others, that is just like what having a human experience is going to be. And obviously there's that, but what if it went even deeper and we were just part of some simulation that existed to like run scenarios for a master race of super intelligent, extra dimensional beings that are just using us as like, we're just marionettes and puppets, and were hooked up to machines like the people in the Matrix, you know. And on some subconscious level, we know that, and we are so existentially vexed by that reality, by the fact that our actual reality is so much more bleak than we could even imagine, that we create God myths and religions and cults because we need to believe in something more fantastical or more great. And that's obviously something that's just like a really, really dark theory of mine. I don't necessarily like believe in it or anything. I don't necessarily like hardcore believe in any of the possibilities that I just put forward. Like I said, I do prefer to lean into the one where we are all God and we are all beings of love and we are all beings of connected energy. I do like that. I do think there's a lot of internal logic to that that tracks for me. There's a lot of internal, self-evident, consistent, intuitive logic there that I can latch into. But also, like, I gotta be aware of my ego, because if I start thinking that, like, I'm immune to my ego, unlike Amy Carlson and the people who followed her, then I am doing the same thing. I'm still making myself special. I have a special brain that is not subject to my ego's desire to push me into terminal uniqueness. I have a special brain that can see the actual truth that we're all just the same thing. And if I'm doing that, aren't I still allowing my ego to trick me into believing that there's something special about me? So yeah, no answers, just some theories and kind of like some grim darkness, but also just some questions about, like, boy, we really struggle with this God stuff. It gets us into a lot of trouble. We were talking about Palestine and Israel earlier. Like, the real thing, the real shitty thing about that whole situation, like the nuts and bolts of it, that like what it comes down to at its core is like a dogmatic dispute, a disagreement over like holy text and holy books and like whose version of God is more correct. And that's so fucking shitty. That's so shitty that like that's been the story of like most of our wars, is whose version of philosophy, theology is like more correct. let's go to the comments. Pirate Pantaloons on TikTok just asked, what's your definition of atheists? I define myself as an atheist. And a lot of people don't like that because I sound more like an agnostic, because I don't, I say I don't know a lot, which is true. I feel very firmly that I don't know and that I can't know. But I think I define myself as an atheist in a traditional sense, because I very strongly don't believe in any man-made God myth that I've heard. Any anthropomorphic God that has a name, that's like some guy. I don't believe that Amy Carlson was the God, the creator of the universe, and like the one and only God. I don't believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ, or in the, like, I don't believe any story that people have come up with an anthropomorphized God that is a guy with some name and a book. I don't believe in. I believe that that is all created by humans and the human ego, as evidenced by this entire conversation. And I believe that that makes me functionally an atheist. I don't believe in the existence, in the literal existence of an anthropomorphic God, humanoid person, God personage. That being said, I do believe that there could be something to an energy or a force or an existence of something that is the thing that people are trying to tap into when they talk about God, when they say the word God and they anthropomorphize it and they call it a him or a her or a them or whatever. I believe that there could be an argument made that there's something that those people are trying to tap into. I just don't believe that, like, it's any of the things that they're saying that it is. Rebecca Tuck asks, intelligent design. Yeah, so I don't necessarily believe, I guess I would say I don't believe in intentional design, that we were, that existence was designed with some kind of intent or plan. It makes more by one thing, by like a creator, by an intelligent creator who got out some blueprints and drew up a blueprint for what a universe was going to look like and what the rules of the universe were going to be. That to me is not something that I believe in. Now, I do believe, again, talking about that this word God could mean everything. And, you know, I like what Eckhart Tolle talks about, that God is being, the essence of being, that the nature of being, that just the fact that there is something and not nothing. This is what a lot of theists talk about. Why is there something and not nothing? Well, being explains that without having to get into the mess of having a designer, having a humanoid person, a guy, some guy who designed it all. Just the fact that, like, the reason why there's something and not nothing is because of being. We are just everything that is in this this state of being. In the same way that, like, you know, time is an illusion and is not real, and the only thing that is real is the present moment. Again, Eckhart Tolle. But that's also, like, something that feels very self-evident and has a lot of internal consistent logic. The reason why time travel can't be possible is because the future is not an actual place. The past is not an actual place. The only place that exists is right now. Just like the only physical place that exists is here, is just this, is just all of this. So I do believe that there's something, there's a hum, a natural hum of energy that connects all of this. And that is what people are touching into when they're connecting with God. Tony Welcher said, we are something. Yes, we are something. So somebody asked earlier, they said, what do atheists believe happens after death? And here's the thing about atheists. So when we're talking about atheism, atheists are not a monolithic belief group. There is not like an atheist Bible. There's not, even AA has, if you ask me, like, what do people in AA believe about this? I can at least point you to literature and say, well, the AA big book says this, or, you know, our traditions say this. I can point you in a direction of like what AA has traditionally stood for. Atheists don't have that. So when people ask, what do atheists think about this? That's not really a question that can be answered definitively, because atheists as a collective don't collectively believe just one thing. Atheist beliefs are not monolithic. The only thing I think that atheists all collectively believe is just like, or agree on, I should say, not even believe, agree on, is that, like, we don't believe in the literal existence of man-made God myths. So that's sort of the only connective tissue. Now, different atheists are going to give you different answers on whether or not there is a continuation after death. A lot of atheists are going to tell you that their belief is that there is not, that there is not a continuation of consciousness, that your experience as whoever you are right now, that this subjective experience that you're having as Sam or Alyssa or Megan, as Austin, that is not going to continue. But that there will be some kind of biological continuation. As we talked about earlier, that, like, you are part of an unbroken biological line of, it's just been, and there will be some kind of, whether you reproduce or not, your body will go into the earth and will be consumed by the earth, and there will be some kind of continuation of what constitutes you after you die. A lot of atheists do believe that the conscious experience will be very similar to the conscious experience that you can recall before being born, which is to say, there will be nothing there. You have no way to quantify what the experience of existence was before you were born, and a lot of people believe that it is logical to assume that you will have no way to have a conscious experience after dying. I don't personally believe that. I believe in a continuation, which is something new in my life in the last few years, and again, I can't give it to you in any concrete, provable way. All I can say is that, like, I've had personal experiences that have led me to think, I think there's more. I think there's something else. I think there's a transformation of a state of being. You go from one state of being into another state of being, but there is some sort of, some part of what makes me me will continue, I think. Can't prove that to you at all in any substantive way. No one can, and no one ever will be able to prove that to you in any substantive way. So it doesn't actually really matter. I just think that there's something beyond the limitation of my physical body. There's more. And again, I think that this all has roots in quantum mechanics and quantum physics and quantum science, that, like, we are aware in quantum physics and in quantum theory that, like, we're only seeing a minuscule portion of the playing board of existence, that, like, there is more. I mean, you know, things like the split sheet experiment, like just being aware that particles of light behave differently when they're being observed than when they're not being observed. If you're not aware of this, I'll give you a very, very fumbling, elementary, rudimentary explanation of the split screen experiment. It's basically just you shoot particles of light through these slits in a piece of paper onto a board, and they appear in one pattern when they're not being observed, when no one's looking at them. They go through and they create a certain pattern, and then when they're being observed, when people are looking at them, they behave differently. And there's all kinds of things like this in quantum physics and quantum energy, where, so, like, all we really know from that experience is that somehow the light particles are aware of being observed, that somehow the nature of us looking at them changes them. And there's a lot of things like this, quantum entanglement, and you know the idea of two objects that are occupying different points in space being affected in the same way. These are things that point to the existence of higher planes of existence, like there's just more going on than what we can process with our eyeballs and our brain and our hands and mouths and noses. And I would like to believe that in death, we get to experience a little more of that extra dimensionality, that there's some part of our consciousness that gets to be released into new, you know, let's say that we're on a board as beings who are having the subjective experience. Let's say that we're on a chessboard where we can move forward and side to side and diagonal, but we're moving flat like this. And then in death, we get to, like, move up and over, and we get to move, like, through the board and get to go down underneath the board and things like that. And it does seem, there seems to be some kind of internal logic to that, that there could be, and there probably is, ways of maneuvering through physical space that are beyond what we can perceive. And so I like the idea of us getting to approach something like that in death. Again, this is all just wishful thinking, and this could very well just be my ego trying to protect me from the actual grim reality, which is I get these few decades of consciousness, and that's it, and I better enjoy them. And Don Quixote on TikTok just said, citation needed is basically the answer, and yes, exactly. I have no citation to actually back any of that up. It's just what I want to be true. And that's really all belief is like, do you want God to be a guy? Do you want God to just be like a guy with a beard whose name you know and who you pray to with that specific name or not? And I don't want God to just be some guy. I don't like that. And so to me, God is not that. And I meet a lot of the qualifications of being traditionally atheist. But I think that a lot of atheists would see some of the ways that I talk and be like, you can't sit with us. But again, atheists are not monolithic in their approach to spirituality and beliefs. They just sort of more or less agree that they don't think that God exists. Thoughts on black holes, asks Tony Welch. God. Like, what the fuck is that? Like, again, you know, like, and this is where, like, the agnosticism comes in, because all you can really say is, I don't know, and neither do you, and nobody does. All we know is that they are there, and we have no idea what's going on there. What's crazy about black holes is that, like, they're out there, and we can observe, they're out there in space sucking shit up and pulling things in with this immense, unthinkably large amount of gravity, but they don't just, like, show up ever, like, here. Like, it's weird that, like, you just think that, like, every once in a while, like, a black hole would just, like, emerge in your bedroom and you'd be like, oh my god, black hole! Like, and, like, it, but, like, no, like, they're just, like, out in these far off reaches of space that we can look at with a telescope. And that implies the potential existence of all kinds of weird phenomena that just maybe, like, don't fit the Milky Way galaxy just, like, doesn't fit the right specifications for hosting that kind of phenomena. And so we won't ever see one in the Milky Way galaxy. Who knows? But there could be all kinds of shit like black holes, because a black hole is just a hole in the middle of three-dimensional space, and that doesn't make any sense. Here's another thing that's kind of crazy, is, like, a hole doesn't really exist. Like, we make holes in physical material, and all we're really doing is just reshaping physical material. So we dig a hole in the ground, but it's not actually a hole. It's just moved earth. It's just taking physical stuff and moving it. We're not actually creating a hole. The only actual, like, real hole that you can think of is a black hole. Like where stuff goes in and we don't know where it goes and it doesn't come back out. And we have no idea where it's going, and it literally feels like a tear in the fabric of reality as far as we can tell and observe. And that's a thing that's real that we have to grapple with and just go, like, yep. Just like with simulation theory, it's like, well, we've got simulations. Like, we right now in the year 2023, whatever the fuck that means, because 2023 is just an arbitrary number that we assigned to this collection of 12 months, doesn't actually mean anything. But in the year 2023, we have functioning simulations that we can plug into and have, like, a pretty damn immersive experience in. So we have to accept that, like, simulations are a reality, that that's a real thing. And then you just have to ask yourself, like, is this the first time that anyone's ever developed a simulation? And is this the most advanced simulation that anyone's ever developed or will develop? And the answer to that question is, like, probably not. You do have to grapple with that thing exists. Same with black holes. It's like, can't tell you at all what that is, but I can tell you that they're out there, and like, what do you do about that? And why would that tie it? What would that have to do? Like, there is nothing in any one of our man-made, ego-driven God myths with any of our books, the Quran, the Torah, the Bible. There's nothing in there about black holes. There's nothing in there about just, like, big, huge, like, wells of gravity pulling in celestial objects, and those celestial objects disappearing into those wells of gravity, never to be seen again. There's nothing about that, but those are things out there. Time dilation. Cody Culp says, time dilation. In a black hole, time slows down or stops, and you would experience copies of yourself. And again, like, we know that time will slow down just because of the theory of relativity and what gravity does to our relative experience of time. And we know that, but I don't think that we actually can know for sure, like, if you were to go in. That's why I love the movie Interstellar. I really like the audacity of Christopher Nolan to just be like, it might as well be this. When Coop goes into a black hole in that movie, Christopher Nolan gets to say, it might as well be this. it might as well be a Tesseract where you get to move sort of in a fifth dimensional way through linear time. Even though I don't think that linear time is actually a thing that exists. I don't think that you can move to the past because the past doesn't exist. But it might as well be that. Christopher Nolan gets to say that it might as well be that because no one actually can say. Rock says, we have detected Hawking radiation, so we actually recently have proof of what can happen in a black hole. Again, the operative word is can. And we have ideas and proof of things that we can speculate with some degree of certainty would happen. But still, it's a thing where it's like, until we like, it's kind of like death. It kind of is one of those things where it's like, we can you know, observe and do all these things and watch people die, and people can have experiences where they're like near death experiences where it's like my heart stopped and my brain stopped working and I exited my body and I saw people outside of my body but like you're never actually going to know for sure what it actually is until you go. And I think that that's how I think that the reason why psychedelic drugs get tied to people having sort of spiritual awakenings and introductions to spirituality a lot is because it's a similar experience of like, I can't actually tell someone what doing acid is like. It has to be experienced by the individual. I can't actually tell someone adequately what doing MDMA is like. They have to just experience it. And I think that a black hole would be much the same way. We can describe it the best we can with what we can observe and what we can, the data we can gather. But that is going to be one of those things where it's like, unless you send a ship out there of people to actually go in there and document what they see and they're able to come back, you know. Arbitrary Alex says, no one knows 10,000%. Again, anyone who does is either manipulating you into a cult or selling something. That's something I wanted to talk about too, about just like cults and religions is like, I think you always have to be wary of anyone who tells you that they've figured it out, that they do have the answer to what God is and how God should be utilized as a tool. And that's why I started this podcast by telling you, I'm not going to tell you that what God is definitively or how it can be used for good, because I don't know. But that's also why I'm skeptical of the belief that I lean toward, because it still is like my ego saying, you're onto it, Austin. You're figuring it out. Everybody else has it wrong, but you're figuring it out. And that makes me skeptical, because my ego really wants to be the one who's figured it out, you know? And so I do think that you need to be skeptical of anyone who tells you, this is for sure what God is. I've got it sorted. Let's see. Good conversation. JB on TikTok says, LOL, I saw Christopher Nolan today. Jealous. Oh my God, I was at a restaurant the other day in Los Feliz, and Los Feliz. I know that like the actual pronunciation is Feliz, because that's how that word is said, but people in LA always say Los Feliz. And I kind of like saying Los Feliz, even though I feel like that's like so white and like colonizer mindset of me, I just think like I like that pronunciation more. but starstruck. So this person saw Christopher Nolan. I was at this restaurant in Los Feliz, and Bo Burnham came in. That's not the starstruck moment. I've seen Bo Burnham like 5 times. It's weird. Bo Burnham and I always wind up at the same place for some reason. I don't know why. Bo Burnham walked by and I was like, oh, look, it's Bo Burnham. And I was like, there he is again. Like, good old Bo. But then Phoebe Bridgers came in and I lost my shit. I was beside myself. I did not know what to do with myself. And I couldn't believe that it was Phoebe Bridgers. And I've never, like, my heart sank and I went, oh! And I grabbed onto my friend Tiffany, who was with me, and I said, Phoebe Bridgers just walked in. And yeah, I think that's the end of the podcast this week. Don't join a cult. it's bad for you. Just be, you know, just stay here in disappointing reality. And just, you know, avoid terminal uniqueness and be wary of your ego trying to make you feel uniquely special in any way that feels a little too good to be true, I guess. Get my record. Late stage capitalism is killing us all, but I still live in late stage capitalism and I need to pay my bills. And if you want to support me and the things that I do, Bandcamp Friday is tomorrow, December 1st. And if you buy my record on Bandcamp, 100% of the sales go to me. And Bandcamp won't take a service fee, which is great. So it's a great way to support tomorrow. That you can get that at austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com or at the links in all of my bios on all of my social medias. It's a great record. It's beautiful. It turned out beautiful. The songs are beautiful. The design of the record looks great. You'll like having it around your house. Beautiful things, the deluxe edition, the double vinyl, the exclusive limited edition, one of a kind double vinyl. Check it out. Link in my bio, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Get it for yourself. Get one for a friend, whatever. Yeah. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com or by searching Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music. Boy, my Spotify Wrapped really depressed me this year. My Spotify artist Wrapped, like, just so few people listened to my music in 2023. And it will never not depress me how many people that follow me on social media have no idea that I make music, but I do. everyone that listens to the podcast, I believe, is aware of it. But anyway, thank you for being here. Thank you for continuing to listen to this podcast, even after I took a brief hiatus. Thanks for being here on live. Thank you for your, comments and feedback and the lively discussion. I really, really appreciate it. Take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and we'll see you on the next one. Maybe I'll get a guest one of these times. I don't know. We'll sort it out. I'll talk to y'all later. Love you so much. Bye-bye.